The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you. We're very honored today to have as the keynote speaker for this event, Ms. Ana Palacio, who's the Vice President and General Counsel of the World Bank Group. And it's my pleasure to invite Dean Grossman to introduce our speaker for today. Dean Grossman.
Thank you, Professor Barlow, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this luncheon celebrating the 25th anniversary of the International Legal Studies Program. I am delighted, as I said already in the morning, to see many of you here to commemorate this significant milestone in the program's history. And I wish I could say that I look forward to the next 25 years, but I'm sure the best is yet to come, and we will continue to work in the promotion of this important educational endeavor. You should know that approximately 300 of you will be participating in the programs and panels of this multi-day celebration. This tremendous response and the fact that you are coming from many countries today here shows how strong is the program and how strong is its future. This morning we had an interesting panel on key developments in international law over the past 25 years and their implications for the next 25 years, on which I was honored to participate and learn from my colleagues. And again, that anticipates very exciting panels that will take place later. But the most important thing is, of course, the networking that you have among yourself, and there's going to be plenty of opportunity for that. The director of the program has created that space in the activity. Now, we have gathered today for this luncheon with a distinguished keynote speaker, Ms. Ana Palacio, Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the World Bank Group, whose topic is, quote, "It's the law, stupid, shifts in development policy," end quote. Our imagination is immediately captured by the word stupid, I would say, and we are all eager to know in what side of the world we are all for. I mean, but that shows the creativity of the current Senior Vice President General Counsel of the World Bank Group. In the conversation we had during lunch, she said, "I prepared written remarks, but I'm not going to read them in this group of lawyers. I'm going to speak not in official terms. And the only thing, if you quote me, be careful, ask authorization in advance." So we appreciate that she will speak in an unofficial manner. When Ms. Palacio was appointed to her current position in the World Bank in June 2006, she brought with her a wealth of experience. She was formerly a member of the Spanish Parliament, where she chaired the Joint Committee of the Two Houses for European Affairs. And we can see her absence from that because we read in the newspapers that there's some issues with getting agreements, and her political skills would have been needed. She served as foreign minister under Prime Minister José María Aznar from 2002 to 2004, during which time she focused on three priority policy areas: European expansion, strengthening transatlantic relations, and fighting terrorism and strengthening EU ties to the Middle East and Mediterranean. While in the Spanish Parliament, Ms. Palacio also chaired the Legal Affairs and Internal Market Committee, the Justice and Home Affairs Committee, and the Conference of Committee Chairman, Parliament's most senior body for the coordination of its legislative work. When I was reading on the official language, I wanted to mention to you, Ms. Palacio, this is a school created by women more than 100 years ago. And we need to change this. They will say Conference of Committee Chairman would be a first problem. Prior to her current appointment, she worked as a consultant for the World Bank at the highest levels. She has degrees in law, political science, and sociology. She's a member of the board of a variety of institutions, including the board of trustees of the Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Institute Montaigne, and Aspen Institute Italy, among others. We are honored to have her here joining us in our celebration. Ms. Palazzo, I invite you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dean Grossman, and thank you, Professor Bradlow, for having invited me. Because I must say, and it's not rhetoric, that I'm extremely honored and pleased to be given this opportunity to what I understand is an exchange of just opinions. And this is why, it, as Dean Grossman said, instead of reading the very thoughtful, well, presentation speech that I had prepared, I'm going to speak out of the cuff, you say, no? It's out of the cuff. For those of you that are familiar with this approach, I would say that I understand that we are applying Chatham House rules, which is no attribution except clear with the person, in this case with me. And now, before I get into the topic, two considerations. First, I am first and foremost a lawyer, and I think that being a lawyer is ontological. You are a lawyer, and whatever you do, you are a lawyer. I have been a lawyer while serving in the European Union, in Brussels, in many different capacities. I have been a lawyer while serving as a foreign affairs minister of my country. And I, as I say, being a lawyer is being it, being ontological. And this is why I'm so pleased to have been given this opportunity to speak today in this 25th anniversary of your institution. And I must say that I will just add to what Dean Grossman said, is that I was extremely pleased to read in the background papers that I read to prepare for today, that you are one of the five most important institutions of your kind, of these international legal studies programs in the United States, as rated by U.S. News and World Report. I think this is a fantastic feature, and I must congratulate all of you, all the alumni, more than 2,000, according to the notes that I have read, coming from over 70 countries, and many of you present here today, which means that you keep a relationship with your alma mater, and that's also an issue to be proud of. And as I say, I feel extremely pleased to have been given the opportunity to share these moments with you. Now, let's go to the topic. I must say that Professor Grossman highlighted that this was a very provocative. Yes, I wanted to be a bit provocative. But by the way, it's more provocative than I wanted to be, because I was quoting. It's low stupid. It's paraphrases. The famous, some of you may know about this famous slogan in the 1992 Clinton campaign, it's economy, stupid. What was the context there? Is that although not apparent in the formal campaign, the real issue, what was really being the core, the challenge, was the recession. And this is why there was this kind of campaign slogan, it's the economy, stupid. Well, just playing with the words and paraphrasing this, I think today in development is low, stupid. It's low, stupid, precisely because the conventional wisdom takes that it is economy, that the development is about economy, and that the development policy is underpinned by a technical system, which is economy. I think that my reflection with you today goes in the direction that, of course, economy is and remains an important technical system underpinning development policy. But there is another technical system, law as technical system, that is just has erupted, is erupting in the context of development policy. So I should have put or the title of the conference somewhere lost the inverted commas. It's the economy stupid, inverted commas, and then this idea of shifts in development policy. But I think it's all right. Let's go to the why I was saying that today the big challenge in development policy in general is to understand, to analyze, to just make sense out of this eruption of law, of legal vision, of legal point of view, of legal sensitivity in this territory that has been colonized for a long time by economists and the economic vision. Let me just, in that respect, begin by an anecdote. As Professor Grossman, Dean Grossman, said, just before joining the bank, I was asked to, as an external consultant, to address the positioning of the bank vis-à-vis legal empowerment of the poor. Legal empowerment of the poor is a very important and interesting initiative, and I hope that in the colloquium there's you will ask me questions so I can explain. And by the way, Christina Bibisheimer, who is chief counsel at the World Bank Group, and she is the point person responsible for this legal empowerment of the poor. So the United Nations had launched this legal empowerment of the poor initiative, a high-level commission with very well-known, very proeminent personalities of the world. And the World Bank had to position itself vis-à-vis this commission. And at a certain moment, the president asked me to just address this issue, because in the end, legal empowerment of the poor, there is no cross-boundary, or there was no cross-boundary. There was not a policy within the World Bank of legal empowerment of the poor. So the approaches were different from different areas of the bank. And I, of course, as you can imagine, I had conversations with many people. I interviewed many people in the bank just to ask them what the bank was doing in the area that could be addressed as in this umbrella of legal empowerment of the poor. And I got very different reactions. And I remember one of the vice presidents, one of the big wigs of the bank, after a long conversation, telling me, but you know, Mrs. Palacio, development. It's 5% sustained growth over 10 years. That's development. And yes, when you have to pick up one program instead of another program, yes, then you can take into account environment, gender, or this issue of yours, what was it? Legal empowerment of the poor. Well, I think it's not the case. This is the old vision. Development is about growth. And you know, the rest is just either taken for granted. Some at a certain moment thought that the invisible hand of the market would make the distribution of this growth. But all the other complementary approaches are always viewed in what their relation with growth is. And this is the old, if you allow me, a word that is abused, and therefore I just say it with a certain suspicion, this is the old paradigm. And we are transiting from this old paradigm. Why? Well, it's very simple. As I say, the the complexity of the world has changed. When this paradigm of development is about growth, how you create, how you help, how you influence growth, macroeconomic growth in the countries, things were quite, of course, these are brushstrokes, and I hope that during the dialogue later we will be able to, but in a way it was just quite simple. The bank was the central agent, international agent, the World Bank. The interlocutor was mainly, if not exclusively, a sovereign government. And between the bank and the sovereign government, they organized programs that would create this growth. In the end, there was, there was the poor. The poor was the beneficiary. And you read in the documents of the bank the beneficiary. Later, when this began to evolve, the poor became the client. And it's not true. We lawyers, we know that a client means a contract, and a contract between just parties that are in relatively equal positions. You're a client, one buys, one sells. The one that buys is the client of the one that sells. But in a relationship between a developing agency, whatever it is, and the poor person that is characterized because of being poor, so a dimension that is purely economic, this idea of a dimension that is purely economic, this was the panorama. And from there, simple or clear-cut world, right now we are in an incredible complexity. Some drivers of this complexity. The first is the eruption of many actors. Today you have discussed this morning the eruption of NGOs in the developing world. NGOs are fundamental actors of development. But it's not just that. It's private individuals. If you are Warren Buffett or you are, I don't know, we have so many private individuals that are playing a key role in development policy, and you are an actor. And then the relationship between national actors and international actors has changed, even in the public. Let me just briefly touch upon the example of Europe. Until very recently, development policy was a junior policy that was linked to the foreign affairs ministries and that was shared with the finance ministries because of Bretton Woods, precisely because of the World Bank and the origins of the World Bank. And we can speak about also the origins of the World Bank later. This was the approach this was a junior policy, and in the end, it was multilateralized. But right now, in Europe, the Europeans identify the challenges we are facing and the threats we are facing, be it food security, which is what preoccupies the Europeans, food security, pandemias, security, what we understand as security, the destruction of just labor or jobs, and illegal immigrations. These are the important issues that just concern the Europeans. All of them are identified or related to the developing world, which means that for the first time for the national governments, the development policy has gone from being a junior, quite a secondary tool, to being one of the principal, if not the principal, tool in international relations. So we see that even what was the statu quo among within the developed world of who was the frontliner, now governments in Europe, for instance, have a certain tendency to renationalize development policy. And at the same time, we have the European Union that is just sees that, as Dean Grossman was saying, we are facing many contradictions and many difficulties. But there is something. If you take a look at the Eurobarometers, Europeans want to have a higher voice for Europe in development. So European institutions are also addressing development policy, which until now was clearly outsourced, if I may say so, to the World Bank, to international institutions, to the United Nations in general, UNDP, all the programs, and basically centrally to the World Bank. So we are changing actors, eruption of private actors, eruption of civil society, and change in the balances between the classical actors of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and the national governments. But it's not just that. It's that the poor people are also important actors. Many of you know that nowadays in many, especially, there are some countries, for instance, in Mexico, remittances mean more than the net foreign investment every year. And of course, much, much more than any of all the programs of all the international finance institutions. So this is a complexity. And why this is linked to law? Because, you know, the only way to address a certain reasonable predictability, reasonable order, is through the legal system. And we are seeing this proliferation of trust funds. Why this proliferation? Because of this. Because this change, these global partnerships, all this. This is a fantastic new field that is opening for us that has to be explored, that I'm sure that you are addressing. But it's not just just individuals. It's also, as I said about this, is the relative amounts. So poor people in many countries are accountable for foreign, if we can call it, from foreign remittances that are extremely important. All this complexity, and we can go into it, means that today the bank counts for about 3% of the just global financial significance of development. We are 20 and something billion against 700 to 800 billions, which is, these are the relative strength. But it's not just this. I would say that another area of complexity is territorial complexity. Why? Because until now, actors, development agencies, and mainly these classical agencies, just had as the interlocutor a government. And they address infrastructure is a good example, but we could take others that were national programs. National programs. Today we know that we have to address two other dimensions: supranational, regional infrastructure programs. My former colleague, if he allows me to call him, my former colleague from the Inter-American Development Bank, was telling me that the Inter-American Development Bank, Mr. Levine, Jerome Levine, was telling was telling me that the Inter-American is launching a huge program, $9 billion, of regional infrastructure in Latin America. And the European Investment Bank is launching an equivalent project in the southern border of the Mediterranean, the Maghreb, the Mashrek region. So we have to look into this supranational. But we have also subsidiarity is extremely important. And subsidiarity means that we have to be closer to our interlocutor, and that we have to address the municipal the region, sub-national or sub-sovereign, once more. And of course, we have to address global challenges, the global public goods that have to be addressed because they are essential for development, be it pandemics, be it global warming, all of these global challenges, and in particular the global goods. Once more, where can you address this just in economic terms? Not at all. You cannot. You cannot. As soon as you transcend as soon as you address this territorial dimension that goes beyond, you have to bring law as a system. But it's also true when you address this subsidiarity approach, just being closer to the citizen. You need the legal system. This is the only way that this is going to be sustainable development, that is going to be coherent, once, because we need to go there with a system. Now, is this all? Well, no. Our interlocutor is changing. Nowadays, we are not addressing poor people in this economic dimension. The poor people are being addressed more and more, and this is the only way to address sustainable development as what they are, citizens, sometimes maybe only potentially, but we have to address them as what they are, citizens, which means rights and responsibilities. Citizenship, this idea of a citizen is purely legal. This is the contrast between poor, addressing our interlocutor as poor, characteristic poor, addressing our interlocutor as characteristic citizen. Once more, centrality of the law. And in this very complex, and I don't want to be too long on this issue, but let me just wind up by saying that, do we have to conclude that institutions like the World Bank do not have a role? On the contrary, I think that institutions like the World Bank have a central role to play. Because in this complex, globalized world, the World Bank has certain characteristics that just the World Bank has. A global network, so we can learn from different what are the best ways to address a fantastic professionals. I must say that I have been at the World Bank 6 months because and it's true that I was appointed end of June, but I didn't take over until September. I couldn't leave the Spanish Parliament from one day to the other. So what I must say that the first thing that strikes in institutions like the World Bank is the fantastic intellectual and human quality of the staff there. I always tend to, one of the anecdotes, because I am learning and I have had to learn a lot at the World Bank, I go very early to the bank, many times before 7, I'm there. And one day and another day, and I would just bump on one of the chief counsels that has been working at the bank for 20 years. And one day I stopped him and said, come with me, I'm buying you a cup of coffee. Oh, well, I don't have much. Well, come with me. When we sat down, I said, what the heck are you doing at 7 o'clock in the morning after 25 years at the bank? That I'm here, yes, because I have a lot to learn. And he just explained to me with such an enthusiasm, like if it was his first, his first day at the bank, what he had, how he was in touch because of the difference, the time zones, how he took advantage of this hour from 7 to 8, 8:30 to just keep track of what the lawyers that were under his supervision were doing. So the human, the professionalism, it's very difficult to evaluate. We tend, from the outside, many, I did, for instance, to tend to think, oh, these are very maybe good professionals, but the heart is not there. No, yes, the heart is there. They are very good professionals and extremely committed. I wouldn't say that absolutely everybody, but a fantastic majority is like that. Third, the World Bank has the ability to convene. In this very complex world where you have to play with different actors from very different nature, the World Bank is the convener. The World Bank can just pull together actors, pull together, and I'm sure that together we would find many more. But out of the cuff, I think that there is but not least, this challenge to to invent the bank. The bank, we all know, was created to reconstruct Europe, and from there the bank reinvented itself as the instrument of the international community of the United Nations to fight poverty. The first instrument. There are others, but just they don't. The bank has this global vision of fighting poverty. It's not sectorial. Has this this encompassing vision of the fight against poverty. And in this fight against poverty, the bank provided the best instrument for developing countries to access the international capital market. Well, nowadays, this is the lending activities of the bank are shrinking, especially in some areas. But the bank has this ability to bring knowledge together with the financial instruments. And I would say that this is really where the challenge of the bank is in these characteristics of the bank. And, as I said at the beginning, it's a great pleasure, and I'm at your disposal for questions. Thank you.
It seems that the bank does not think, or at least that's my view, that the citizens have the power to use their discretion, in the sense they don't receive directly the revenue, in this case, of the oil they cannot spend. They cannot control that money because they must, but the government should use those money for infrastructure. So I think that, nevertheless, in that situation, it's just the lack of the control of the citizens that provoked that situation that happened there, the lack of accountability. And so I wonder if you see that a different system, for example, to providing to the people directly some parts of the revenue and tax them if they don't invert their money in, for example, in enterprises or company and just receive them after they're 16 so they don't use this for the way of incremental population.
Well, thank you for two excellent questions, and I will begin by the first one, which in fact I had asked for just for you to give me an opportunity to revisit this what I told you about legal empowerment of the poor. Well, in fact, it's true that at the origin, this high-level commission was very focused on Hernando de Soto's work and on Hernando de Soto's theory, which is exactly this. In the end, it's about titling, because when if you allow me a simplification, as always, it's hideous, but the poor people have capital. They cannot use this capital. This capital can be the dwelling they live in or a small plot or something, but they don't have property. This is not title. So let's title, and they will use it as collateral. This is a simplification, but it's the simplification of that just underlines this approach. The truth of the matter is that right now the Legal Empowerment of the Poor Commission has broadened up, and it's needed. I mean, in the end, what the thrust behind the commission, and maybe later, Christina, I will ask her if she wants to add anything. The thrust of the commission is twofold. First, that legal existence is per se a challenge. There are many people out there that do not exist legally, and this means today that they cannot just buy a cell phone, they cannot just go to school, there are a lot of handicaps, and especially in this very complex world where new technologies are so close, paradoxically, this legal existence. And then the truth of the matter is that law in many cases is an obstacle. It does not empower people. Law exists is an obstacle to poor people to leave the poverty trap. So this legal empowerment of the Poor Commission has now five working groups. One, access to justice, which is basic to empower legal people. In this access to justice, by the way, this idea of legal existence, which is linked to it. The second one is property rights, in a much broader approach, because you have collective titling. It's not just this, it's other property rights, not just this land titling individually or property titling individually. Then the third would be tackling informality, all this just informal economy that is out there. How to address it, how to make legal frameworks usable, friendly to poor people. You have in many of your, you are aware that in many countries it takes 100 days, 200 days to register a business. I mean, how come? You cannot. If you are just a small, you are launching a business, you remain in the informal economy. So, what are the approaches? What are the entry points to this informal economy? Is another of the working groups. Labor law is another working group. It's extremely important. Economic and social rights. I haven't just touched upon this idea of human rights being at the core of this approach. That our interlocutor is a citizen with even potentially, but all the rights and responsibilities. And at the core, the foundation of all this is the human rights. And then there is a gender, because there is a gender working group that cuts across in labor, in access to business, in access to property. Gender intervenes. And then, if Christina doesn't correct me, the last working group is a working group on tools, how to organize all this. So you are perfectly right in saying that this approach to just titling and using it as collateral is a very reductionist approach, and that legal empowerment of the poor is much broader a challenge, much, much broader. Now, if you allow me, microfinance is a fantastic instrument, and microfinance allows people not to die of hunger. But we know now that the aim to escape the poverty trap is to go from microfinance to just a small business. And we, we have to insist on the microfinance projects that have given so good results. But we cannot forget that microfinance has its limitations, and we have to overcome this. Your second question. Well, on this I will answer as a World Bank Group General Counsel. I will tell you that the World Bank Group is not an enforcer. We cannot go ultra vires of the Articles of Agreement. And one of the limitations we have is the political interference with the interest. And you may say, and many times when I have a dialogue with, especially with NGOs, they would like to have a much more active, much more proactive World Bank. But I tell them, well, but it would be a different institution. You know what? The World Bank cannot go beyond its Articles of Agreement. And in this respect, we cannot just decide that certain amount will be distributed among the... This is for the government. Our interlocutor is still today... This is one of the limitations. We are trying to enlarge our relationship with other actors, in particular with civil society actors. And if some of you have had the curiosity to read the, or will have the curiosity because it's not yet published, to read our governance and anti-corruption strategy that was just endorsed by the board of the World Bank last week, you will see that there is a paragraph on how to address, and this was a paragraph that was discussed once and again, because this is one of the areas where the World Bank Group has to adapt to the complexity of the world and to see that there are some shortcomings in just having the government, the national, the sovereign government as the privileged interlocutor. So, we do what we can, but we cannot forget that we have the Articles of Agreement. We are not an NGO. We do not have the freedom. And the World Bank cannot either be a herald or advocate. We have to understand where we stand. And where we stand, we have a big margin of maneuver. It's not that I say that the World Bank cannot or should not do anything. We have to do, we are doing, but we cannot do the same things that an NGO can do. And this is the role of the NGOs. We have to share roles and we have to just partner in who is the best adapted to do what. So, who else? Yes.
Thank you very much for your comments. This really is wonderful to hear you, and we are very, very happy that you're in Washington. We had a chance to have you here. I have two observations, and I don't know if they're accurate or not. One is that from my experience, limited experience of interaction with the World Bank, there seems to be still the economist's role, and there mm-hmm. is a limited vision of in minds of some as to what is the role of a lawyer and what lawyers can do. And I'm wondering how you would tackle some of, because I think the rule of law has improved, but I'm not so sure that everybody understands that. And, still it's very much they see the lawyers as, I would think it would be somewhat frustrating, other than in your position to be general counsel, you can do all sorts of things, but the majority of the staff, they're very much limited in what they can do with the projects and the work they can do. They're sort of like secondary to the economist. And so how does one address that culture that has been there for such a long time? And the second thing is, totally unrelated, it's just a comment. How does one overcome the distrust of the law that is so deep in such a large part of the world? And how does it, given the colonial legacy and all of that that has existed and will continue to exist, and particularly language of neocolonialism through the World Bank and all, you see some of that attitudes as well if you're thinking about coming up with sort of giving technical advice on that front. Although I do think the World Bank didn't do enough of that initially during the legal reform project in the 1990s. They'd say, again, it was the lawyers said this is not. When I went to talk to people at the World Bank, the legal department, this is not what we do. We don't assess things within a larger framework. Our mandate is very limited as to what lawyers do with the bank. So, just
well. Another two extremely interesting questions, and each one of them would be worth another intervention. Well, you are right, and this is why, I think that your colloquium today is so important, because yes, we have to face a cultural change, a cultural revolution, if you allow me, a cultural revolution. The development policy field, as I said at the beginning, and this has been colonized for a long time by economists, and it's not going to be easy to just put this legal vision, this legal approach, just make the economies that are in the first instance the ones that are responsible for this economic, for this development policy, understand that yes, development is about growth. Yes, economy is a technical system underpinning development policy, but law is another needed. Law as a technical system is another needed instrument we have to explore, because right now we have a very normative approach, value-based, and we say justice is good for development. But we don't have that much analytical underpinning. This is one of the things that we realized when we were addressing legal empowerment of the poor. We need much more analytical underpinning. How all these entry points, legal entry points, what are the consequences in development? In development understood not just as growth, but as growth and distribution, which is the essence of sustainable development. So you are absolutely right. We have to address it. It's not easy. I was, when I joined the bank, there were some expressions that were current expressions, like in the legal vice presidency, our clients, and say, who are our clients? Are you speaking about the government? No. The network X or the region Y, so within the bank. There was this relationship that the legal vice presidency, the legal advice, was an advice that you call the lawyer when you thought that you needed. What the challenge is that legal vision has to be upstream before the bank just thinks of a project, thinks of a CAS, sets in motion any project, any action. Legal vision has to be incorporated. And then it has to be mainstream in everything that the World Bank does. If we are consistent with this idea that development is about economy as a technical system, but also law as a technical system, you have to take the two. And by the way, the seven, if I'm correct, Professor Bradlow mentioned the seven different specialities that you have here. All of them are connected with what I'm saying, because even copyright or intellectual property, all this is fundamental, and fundamental in very many different levels, because there is also behind the legal system, we have human rights, and human rights are value-based, so we have values. But from a very technical point of view, in order just to achieve sustainable development, in order to have a coherent, reasonable, healthy distribution for just to maintain growth, we have to address this. Now, distrust. This is a real issue. This is a major issue. This is a major issue. Poor citizens around the world see that do not see an ally or how law empowers them. In general, they see law as an instrument of oppression. And how can you change this? Well, by proving the contrary, which means that once more, we are addressing cultural changes. Just let me give you an example. This is, by the way, related to your question. The World Bank was the one that implemented Hernando de Soto's vision in Peru. And when I read this, how this project was, how it developed, the first thing, and this is why legal vision is so important, the first thing that the World Bank realized is that, of course, the life is much more complex than this idea that you cannot isolate a dimension. So it's not that easy that you go there and you title. It's much more complicated. The first thing that the World Bank colleagues that addressed this program realized that nobody knew who was living in these slums outside Lima. And they began to study who lives there. Of course, it was very difficult because people did not want to tell them who they were. The first thing, they had to create a trust relationship. This is the first thing, because nobody wanted to see them. These were these big pockets of poverty that the slums of the big developing cities are many times, are off limits of anything. And the first thing is that you are perceived as, well, who knows, probably he will be coming here to tax us, to put another levy on us. Once this relationship, this trust relationship was created, the first thing that was apparent is that many of these households, the head of the household was a woman in an irregular marital status, because either the man had three or four families, he was polygamous against the law, or just the man had left the family and nobody knew. But had you titled, I'm sure that he would have come back and just sold the property or whatever. So the first thing that, in order to just be able to title, to change the World Bank, had to address changing the family law. And they did. Second thing, now we have, we know who is there, we have addressed this, but what about, what are we going to title? Because seen from the outside, it seems that this is different and off limits, there are not conflicts. Yes, there are. Is this my lot or is this yours? My lot just reaches here or reaches here. So the World Bank had to put in place a conflict resolution system. What I'm saying by this is that at each step you had to create trust. People in general, and I would say people that survive in these conditions are extremely when they understood that this was interesting for them, they cooperated. So is it easy? No. Is it true that in many parts of the world, in principle, poor people, poor citizens think that that law is not on their side? Yes. Can you change it? Yes. And there are many examples. I have given this one. Yeah. Dean Grossman.
You're
right.
Especially only you can act on the basis of official information. So there is a side of this policy that is internal, that means restructuring systems of system of guarantees.
Yeah.
So, for example, for the World Bank, a very interesting development was the creation of inspection funds to assess the environmental labor practices. Aren't there other initiatives that are being contemplated to institutionalize and fuel this process that are related to this commitment to the legal empowerment of the world that would create more space for non-governmental organizations? I mean, at the end, the bank decides in accordance with articles of agreement, but these are ways to enrich the decision-making process, and at the same time, it projects, it involves people in the procedure. Or the, when the universities are seeing that universities are not the only ones now who do education, teaching, and service. And we have boards, we create contact with the civil society. So I wonder if there are initiatives contemplated to create more space for civil society.
Well, in your question, the endorsement, I would separate two aspects. One is in general ownership for citizens. Of course, it's central. As I said, we have changed the approach to our interlocutor. It was a hierarchical. If you say that someone is beneficiary, is that one is here and is giving and the other one is just receiving. Now it's really a partnership, and there is ownership. Of course, as I say, for the World Bank, the privileged interlocutor is the government. But we are we have an array of other ways to address this ownership issue within what is our Articles of Agreement. You have touched upon another issue, which is accountability of international institutions, and I'm sorry that I will just be very brief because we are running out of time, and I see that Professor Bradlow is just thinks that I'm overstepping on the next session, and I don't want it because it will be extremely interesting, and my only regret is that I cannot stay. But just to be just very brief, these international organizations need, for the fulfillment of their mandate, need these specialities in the accountability, in the liability, in the responsibility, in all these fields that we call immunities. But this comes with the responsibility to create mechanisms of accountability. And yes, of course, the inspection panel is, as you very well know, the mechanism by which the bank just contrasts or benchmarks banks' actions against our policies and procedures. So are we fulfilling our own policies and procedures, the rules that we have given ourselves? And this is one of the accountability mechanism. In order to, of course, it gives voice to the citizens in the developing countries that could be affected by a program of the bank. But I would say that the inspection panel, as other mechanisms, are much more mechanisms that have to be linked with these immunities of the bank and the need for the bank to comply and to be sure to be extremely strict in the compliance of the bank's actions with our policies and procedures. And empowering citizens in developing countries is just a byproduct, is a very welcome byproduct, but it's not the aim. The aim of the inspection panel is not to empower people, is to make the bank fully comply with our policies and procedures. So thank you all. It has been a pleasure, and I hope that Dean Grossman, we will be together in 25 years to celebrate the 50th anniversary. Yeah, 50 years, in 25 more years to celebrate the 50th anniversary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Palacio. Your remarks today built magnificently on the first session this morning in highlighting, firstly, how complex the world has become and in which the World Bank must operate, but also for helping us to begin thinking through how we can begin responding to some of the challenges that's created. You've reminded us that economic development is not just about making better transactions work more efficiently and more profitably, but also working out how it can be done in a way that can include the marginalized, like the poor, empowering them and allowing them to participate in the process so that we all benefit from it. I think you answered Dean Grossman's question of what stupid means when by saying that it's economists who still believe that development is growth of each year of 5%. I want to thank you for at least reminding and giving lawyers that comfort in knowing that. Also, to say that I think that what you touched on in all of this is to say is really what the ultimate motivation of the International Legal Studies Program. It's to train those lawyers who have the skills and the expertise to play a role in economic development as lawyers that promotes more efficient and more effective transactions, but that also opens up the development process to be environmentally sustainable and open to all population groups and to all human beings to participate in that process. And so I want to thank you very much for coming and beginning a dialogue, which we hope can be an ongoing dialogue. Just as a token of our appreciation, I have a small gift for you on behalf of the law school.
Thank you. Thank you.
Finally, I want to thank all of you for coming, and also just to end with some housekeeping announcements. The afternoon session begins, I think, in about 10 or 15 minutes. As you know, the sessions are concurrent now, and there'll be three sessions in three different rooms. I don't have a copy of the program, so I can't tell you which session is in each room. But if you look in your programs, if someone can give me a program, then okay, so at the first session in room 600, and probably the easiest way to get to 600 is to go straight down this corridor to the very end and turn left, is the session on domestic violence in the context of HIV/AIDS, lessons from Africa. The session on counterfeiting is in room 528, which is obviously on the fifth floor. And then in room 603, the room we were in before, is the session on is the WTO a development organization. After those sessions, as you know, there'll be a second set of sessions later this afternoon, and we'll put up a notice so you can learn where to go for those. And then there's a reception this evening, as you know, at the law firm of Winston and Strawn. There'll be buses, for those of you who need transport, there'll be buses downstairs in front of the law school at 6 o'clock. There'll be two buses at 6 o'clock and then a third bus at 6:30. So please, if you're down there, the buses will be there. And if, for those of you who don't want to take the buses, who want to go on your own there, the address is 1700 K Street. And as I said, it begins at 6:30. So let me thank you all once again. Thank Ms. Palacio very much for joining us for this occasion. And we'll see you in the next sessions.